The car rolls up to the curb, and the woman hesitates only briefly before moving through the dark night toward the open window. She exchanges words with the driver for a moment, and then opens the door and gets into the car. The puff of exhaust fumes is the only thing that remains lingering in the air after they disappear into the night. It stands witness to the moment a predator struck. This is True Crime South Africa. I'm Nicole Engelbrecht, and you're listening to episode 152, A Serial Killer Among Us. This episode is sponsored by the brand new release movie, Sleeping Dogs. Crime film fans, listen up. This one has got every element of crime you could ask for playing out on screen. Ex-murder detective Roy Freeman has a problem. A man is on death row for a murder he claims he didn't commit, and the secrets to solving the murder and saving the man's life seem to be locked away in Roy's head. Roy, played by Russell Crowe, has been working on healing his fractured memory, and now it's not just his own life that hangs in the balance. As he's forced to return to a murder investigation he doesn't remember, Roy finds that a sinister web of buried secrets and betrayals might just link the case to his own murky past, and the closer he gets to the truth, the more he starts to believe it might be safer to let sleeping dogs lie. Starring Russell Crowe and Karen Gillan, and directed by Adam Cooper, Sleeping Dogs hits the big screen in South Africa on the 19th of April, and if you entered the giveaway for free tickets to see the movie, this is your moment. A huge congratulations, and a set of double tickets and refreshment vouchers go out to... Jamie Lee C. and Kayla Simone Goldberg. If you didn't get lucky this time, pause this episode and go book your tickets to see Sleeping Dogs. The trailer is incredible, and it's a must-see for crime genre fans. A huge thank you to Sleeping Dogs for sponsoring this episode of True Crime South Africa. Since 2019, True Crime South Africa has been telling the stories of the victims of violent crime in South Africa. The podcast is independent. That means no big or even little corporates fund it. And that's just the way I like it. And it's the only independent podcast in South Africa that consistently charts in the top 10. Keeping a podcast like this going is time-consuming. And for the most part, it remains a one-woman process. It's me. I'm the one woman. You, yes, you, are the reason this podcast continues to flourish and help bring in tips on missing person and cold cases. If you'd like to help keep the show running, please consider supporting our sponsors, signing up to Patreon or PayPal, follow the show on the socials, as the kids say, and share it with your fellow partners in crime. You can find our social links and learn more about our sponsors at truecrimesouthafrica.com/donate. Shout out to this week's Patreon and PayPal superstars. A huge thank you goes out to Agnes Chomba for your support on Patreon. Thank you so much for your support, everyone. It makes a huge difference. Patreon supporters get one additional exclusive episode a month, a shout-out on the pod, and other exclusive contents including Q&As with me as and when it's available. It's a minimum of $1 a month. I think you should do it. Please. And thank you. Keba. This episode is another that originally appeared in the Patreon feed. But if you heard it there, this is most definitely not the same episode. I've found a ton more information on this case, so it's definitely worth a re-listen if you're a Patreon member. I know that not everyone is super keen on unsolved cases, so I will say up front that this is an unsolved case. This case also recently featured in the Showmax original Catch Me a Killer, based on profiler Mickey Pistorius's book of the same name. It's a serial murder case, and I've only ever done one other unsolved serial murder case on the podcast before. My sources for this episode include Mickey Pistorius's book, Strangers on the Street, as well as several media articles. So let's get into episode 152, A Serial Killer Among Us.
The following episode may contain sensitive material, including descriptions of violence, sexual assault, or graphic descriptions of injuries to victims. If you feel you may be triggered by such material, please consider this before accessing our content. To access trauma counseling or services, please see the helpline information on our show notes.
In other episodes, I've spoken about how South African serial killers are quite different from serial killers in the US, for instance. In statistics released in 2009 in the United States, it was estimated that at least 43% of known victims of serial killers in that country were sex workers. This statistic replicates itself in many other countries too. But interestingly, this only seems to be overwhelmingly true in countries where there are not a huge number of unemployed or destitute people. In countries like India and South Africa, sex workers do not make up nearly as high a percentage of serial murder victims. For the most part, it's believed that this is because when a country has a large percentage of its population living in poverty, those people are automatically considered at risk, and in a serial killer's eyes, easy prey. Of course, not all serial killers will target at-risk victims or those from under-resourced households, but they certainly know that if they do, they have a better chance of getting away with their crimes for longer, and it'll make finding and luring victims far easier too. Another interesting aspect of serial murder crimes in South Africa, where sex workers are the victims, involves the profile of the perpetrator convicted for such series. Although we've had very few of these kind of series in South Africa, almost all the perpetrators convicted of killing multiple sex workers were white males. Of course, we did recently have a young black male who was convicted of the murder of six sex workers in Johannesburg, so that does break the trend a bit. But prior to that, almost all were white males with permanent employment and their own vehicles. There is undoubtedly much more behind the psychology of why that profile of killer may choose sex workers as their victims, but in general, and even including the most recent conviction, the commonality was that all these men were from resourced backgrounds, would be able to pay for sex work transactions, and had their own vehicles to transport the sex workers out of the area they'd picked them up in. An interesting statistic that I stumbled upon is that in the period between 2018 and 2019, nearly half of all sex workers who died in South Africa were murdered. During that period, 101 sex workers lost their lives. So close to 50 of them were murdered. Were there really 50 separate murderers committing those crimes, or were there a couple of serial killers in there that we just don't know about? We know that murders, rapes, and other physical attacks on sex workers are not given the same amount of attention by police that the same crimes on other citizens are. In addition to this, there's the aspect that most of these murders would be what are called stranger murders. Because the victim, in this case the sex worker, would likely be meeting the killer for the first time. We know from experience that stranger murders are some of the most difficult to solve. All investigations start with those closest to the victims, because in at least 8 out of 10 cases, a victim is murdered by a person known to them. When a victim is killed by a stranger, the chances of solving the murder diminish, and investigators would need to rely on witness sightings and biological evidence to find the killer. Within sex worker circles, it's quite rare for anyone to willingly speak to police about what they've seen. It does happen, of course, but not unless those officers have earned the trust of the workers in that area. In addition to that, any biological evidence like DNA found is only valuable if you have a suspect to compare it to. All these roadblocks add up to make violent crimes against sex workers incredibly difficult to solve. Although not impossible, of course, if enough attention is given to the case. The area around which the crimes in this series centred is called Paro, and it's in the Western Cape. Paro is quite a diverse area. It splits almost down the middle by a very long road called Voortrekker Road, and there are parts of the area that are mainly businesses and others that are mainly residential. Some middle class and some housing the poor in the community. And when the sun goes down, Paro's nightlife comes out. Well, really much of this happens during the day too, but it's certainly more prevalent at night. And this includes sex workers, drug dealers and gangsters. In 1996, when sex workers started disappearing from the streets of Paro, it was immediately clear that something was off. The predominantly female sex workers of Paro were fiercely protective of the area they worked in. Many carried knives for protection, and they would almost never allow a client to take them out of the area. But these same women were suddenly being found murdered in rural areas, sometimes 90 kilometres away from Paro. Quite soon after, it became clear that there may be a serial killer on the loose, a task team was assembled. Sergeant Pitful Yun of the Peninsular Murder and Robbery Unit, as it was called at the time, was put in charge of the task team. Now, you may be thinking, well, that's pretty fast moving. They're really putting some weight behind protecting these sex workers. But no. Sadly, it would emerge that although the 1996 movement was pretty fast, when Ful Yun started to look into other similar cases, he realized that the perpetrator had actually been active since 1992. For 4 years, sex workers had been mysteriously disappearing from the streets of Paro, being found in surrounding rural areas, murdered, and no one had really noticed. To Ful Yun's credit, he managed to identify up to 19 cases that he believed contained the same modus operandi. The oldest case identified was 22-year-old Christine Filtain, who was found murdered in Atlantis in October 1992. Then Elizabeth Martinsich vanished and her body was discovered in March 1993 in Worcester. 29-year-old Sarah Mankies was found deceased in Philadelphia in the same month. And before March 1993 was over, the killer seemed to have taken yet another victim when Francina Manuel was found murdered in Durbanville. The next victim sadly remains unidentified to this day. She was discovered in July 1993 in Kraaifontein. Nolundi Mbokwana was just 23 years old when she disappeared and was found murdered in September 1993 in Gordon's Bay. The next linked case occurred the following year in March 1994. That is a very long gap in between for the killer not to have committed any crimes, so either he was otherwise occupied, incarcerated, or there were murders that weren't linked to him. In that March, however, the body of 22-year-old Almarie Engelbrecht was discovered in Worcester. In June that year, Susanne Opperman was found murdered in Gordon's Bay. The next month, 23-year-old Margaret Phillips was killed in Somerset West. In August 1994, Bridget Lint was found murdered in Milnerton. then there is a full year without another victim. And in September 1995, the killer returned and took three more victims in 1 month: Shireen Yusta, Marilyn Percent, and Patricia Gibson. In October, Shahida Abrams was found deceased in Durbanville, and the following January, Gloria Samuels was found murdered also in Durbanville. It would be Gloria's case that brought a particular suspect onto the radar, as I'll discuss in a moment. It was also at this time, when looking back at the chronology of the series, that the killer had switched victim type. All of the victims before and including Gloria were engaged in sex work at the time of their deaths. In March and April 1996, though, the killer moved his hunting ground to Brackenfell and targeted three domestic workers, Frances Celliston, Katrina Fredericks, and Elizabeth Thompson. Although the switch in victim selection might seem strange, it's important to remember that these women would also have been considered vulnerable. They would be earning a relatively low wage and would likely be interested in taking on additional work. They would probably be walking home from their employer's home in Brackenfell and could easily have fallen victim to a man pulling over and asking them if they were looking for additional cleaning jobs. As we've seen with other serial killers, the lure of additional employment is almost definitely enough to get a vulnerable victim to get into a vehicle with a stranger. And that is very likely what occurred here. The last of the cases linked to this series would also be the youngest victim. Teresa van der Vint was just 16 years old and working as a sex worker in Makassar when she disappeared and was found murdered in May 1996. As Detective Viljoen identified these cases, he, along with the task team, visited the crime scenes and spoke to the families and friends of the victims. Slowly, a picture began to emerge of how the nameless and faceless killer had been operating. Almost without fail, victims were taken on rainy nights. Police believed the killer would select his victim and call her over to his vehicle. Once they'd agreed on a transaction, the man would take his victim in his vehicle to a nearby parking lot. As it was raining on most nights that the victims disappeared, it's believed the killer would use this to his advantage. People would likely not be walking around much, so he would be free to do whatever he wanted in his car without anyone disturbing him. Almost all the victims had injuries to their faces, which were consistent with a punch. It was likely that this was how the killer was disabling his victims. Once they were in his car, he would make them undress and then punch them in the face until they were unconscious. Then he would strangle his victims to death in the car. The areas in which the victims' bodies were abandoned, I don't like to use the term dump sites, were all rural, but they were all also pretty difficult to find. Almost all the victims had been picked up in Paro, and it seemed clear that he was killing the victims in his car and then taking their bodies out to these different areas to get rid of them. The furthest area in which a body was found from Paro was Vista, which is about 92 kilometers away. One of the key things to note, though, is that all of the general areas were places easily accessible from a main road or highway. The exact body abandonment sites indicated some knowledge of each area, though. Now, each killer has their own comfort zone, as we know, and as we've discussed before. These are areas they either live in, have worked in, or have some other knowledge of. Because it was unlikely that the killer had once lived in all of these places, it seemed far more likely that he had knowledge of them through his work. The killer had been profiled as an employed person with his own vehicle And so police believed that the suspect was likely someone who travelled through these areas during the day for his work. The man was probably scoping out these areas during daylight hours, and then when he'd identified the place he wanted to use, he would hunt a victim that same night. After killing her in the parking lot, the offender would drive his victim's body out to the area he'd identified earlier in the day and leave her body there. The added benefit of the rain, whether the perpetrator thought this far or not, is that it often washed away his tire tracks. I also have to wonder whether he was consciously choosing all these different areas to ensure that one jurisdiction's SAPS office was not seeing all the murders. Interestingly, even in a period of time where not much information was publicly available about serial killers and their modus operandi, at least in South Africa, with the whole true crime content genre not really having taken off yet, the offender seemed to understand that police would be looking for similarities between scenes to link his crimes. As such, he seemed to go to great lengths to stage the scenes where he left his victims in different ways. Sometimes he would partially bury his victims, at other scenes he posed the women as though they'd been raped. On this point, it did not appear that the perpetrator had ever sexually engaged with any of these women before, during, or after the murders. In her book, Strangers on the Street, Mickey Pistorius says that, to her, this indicates that the perpetrator may have been impotent and incapable of performing sexual acts. Essentially, to the perpetrator, it's likely the murder itself gave him a feeling similar to sexual gratification, but it seemed important to him that those discovering his victims would believe he had raped the women. The irony of the fact that the killer had so clearly attempted to throw police off his tracks was that, in doing so, he created his very own signature. His signature was the repeated attempts at staging. When Detective Viljoen positively identified the series, to his credit, he went to great lengths to attempt to protect sex workers in the Paro area and alert them to the danger on the streets. He spoke to the regular workers and asked them to cooperate by giving him their fingerprints and photographs. Sadly, this would not stop them from being killed, of course, but it would help police to identify their bodies if they were found deceased. Ilse Poe, a clinical psychologist who co-founded SWET, the Sex Workers Education and Advocacy Task Force, recalled in a later newspaper article that there was a, quote, general panic on the streets, end quote, with sex workers intensely mistrusting clients, even if they had known them for years. She said, quote, some women definitely stopped working or became pimps instead because they were so scared, but for most of them it was the only job they had and they had to keep on working, end quote. She also said that Sergeant Viljoen had done an incredible job of earning the sex worker community's trust. Quote, his dedication was remarkable. He absolutely went out of his way to protect sex workers. They are typically the rejected people of society, and people felt they deserved almost any abuse they got. But here was a policeman who stood up for them. End quote. The women were very often hesitant to go into the police station, so Viljoen organized with SWET to take the women's statements in a place they felt safe. Police also printed and posted flyers all around Paro with the emergency numbers to call if they believed they'd come into contact with the killer. Sex workers started to record the registration numbers of the vehicles that their friends were picked up in, just in case they didn't come back. A 500,000 rand reward was eventually put out for information that led to the arrest and conviction of the killer. Soon, An interesting lead came in pertaining to Gloria Samuels. Gloria had unfortunately only been found when she'd been deceased for many days, and she was severely decomposed. But a Coca-Cola bottle was found inserted into her vagina. Now, foreign body insertion is actually very rare in all murder cases, including serials. So, although this could just have been the killer's way of staging the scene, there did seem to be a connection between the killer's possible impotence, as indicated by Pistorius, and the use of a foreign body to assault the victim. This very particular action was then also reported by a local sex worker as a fantasy of one of her regular clients. The man, who was elderly and drove a blue Bucky, had often expressed to the woman that he wished to insert a Coke bottle into her vagina. The description of the vehicle also piqued police's interest, because a similar-looking vehicle had been spotted in the vicinity of where Gloria's body had been found. A blue Bucky had also been spotted in the Paro area when many of the victims had gone missing. Sergeant Fuyun was soon able to identify the suspect. The man lived in a caravan just off Voortrekker Road. Fuyun interviewed the man's ex-wife, who said that the man would often disappear for hours on end during the day and at night without being able to explain where he was. The man was newly retired, but when he had worked, he'd been a delivery driver for his employer. The routes on which the victims' bodies had been found married up with the routes he'd driven at his previous employer. The man's ex-wife said he'd claimed he suffered from blackouts and amnesia, and there were long periods of time he alleged he could not account for. She said he'd been admitted to Tigerberg Hospital for treatment of this condition in the past. Fuyun went to the hospital and was able to determine that one of these admissions for blackouts and amnesia occurred the day after Gloria Samuels went missing. The tests conducted on the suspect during his hospital admission picked up no neurological or other medical explanation for the blackouts and amnesia he claimed to be experiencing. It was also confirmed by the man's ex-wife that he'd been impotent for some time, and the sex workers who had conducted transactions with the man also stated that more often than not, he had been unable to attain an erection during sexual acts. In April 1996, Sergeant Fuyun brought the suspect in for questioning. From the get-go, it was clear that the man was playing games with police. He told Fuyun that it was possible he could have killed the woman, but because of his blackouts and amnesia, he might not remember. So he said if police could prove he was guilty, he would accept that he had done the deeds. During the interview, the suspect spoke about his childhood. He told Fuyun that he'd shared a bed with his mother until he was 16 years old. He claimed that also when he was 16, he was seduced by an older woman into his first sexual experience. His father passed away when he was a teenager, and his mother allegedly brought home many young boyfriends. The suspect's ex-wife also told police he'd contracted a sexually transmitted infection from a sex worker. Fuyun searched the suspect's vehicle. The interior passenger side was brushed for fingerprints, and one set ended up matching to Francis Celestin, one of the domestic workers who'd been murdered. Police also found several pieces of women's jewellery in the vehicle, which they thought could have belonged to the victims. This simply placed the women in the man's car, though. Given that Francis was a domestic worker, not a sex worker, it might be slightly more difficult to explain away, but even then the suspect could just say that he'd given the woman a lift. Her fingerprints being there didn't necessarily prove he had killed her. Also, more information about these fingerprints would emerge a few years later, but I'll tell you about that in a bit. The fingerprints were simply not enough to hold the suspect at the time, and he was released from custody. He was, however, kept under surveillance, but occasionally he would slip away without the posted officer noticing, and without fail on the days he did, another body appeared. In that period, Katrina Fredericks, Elizabeth Thompson, and Teresa van der Vint were killed, so if they were indeed part of the same series, and this suspect was the killer, the surveillance could not have been all that great. Eventually, the surveillance was pulled entirely because police simply didn't have the resources to keep it up. Soon after this, the number of missing sex workers slowed down to a trickle. The workers had become more vigilant, and of course, news had spread that one particular man in a blue bucky was a no-go, no matter how much money he offered. Around this time, Sergeant Viljoen was transferred and was no longer in charge of the investigation. In his place, Inspector George Lochner continued to investigate in the hopes that the killer might make a mistake they could use against him. And Lochner's patience paid off. On the 21st of June 1996, a telephone call came into the police control room. The person claimed to be the serial killer they were looking for and threatened that as soon as his bucky was fixed, he was going to start killing more women. Of course, all incoming calls to the control room are recorded, and Lochner was able to prove that the voice on the tape matched the voice recorded during the interviews they'd held with the suspect in question. Soon after, he was re-arrested by Lochner. The suspect was sent to Falkenberg Psychiatric Hospital for 30 days evaluation, and then he was transferred back to Polsmoor as an awaiting trial prisoner. Interestingly, while awaiting trial, the suspect befriended another man whose name would go down in South African serial killer history, Afzal Simons, who was believed at the time to be the station strangler. Simons would eventually be convicted of just one murder, and he was recently released on parole. But while he was awaiting trial, he and the suspect on this series quickly struck up a friendship and spent all of their time together. The suspect in question here was quite a handful for the justice system. He regularly refused to appear in court and was constantly hiring and firing defense attorneys. Seemingly to ensure the man received a fair trial, the judge remanded the case on each occasion. Eventually, by September 1997, more than a year after the suspect had been arrested, the Attorney General of the Western Cape ruled that there was insufficient evidence to charge the suspect with murder. This was the days before the NPA was formed, of course. An inquest was held into the 19 murders, and it was determined that although murder was without a doubt the cause of death, there was no single suspect that could be fairly tried for the crimes. So, if you're wondering why I've never said this man's name and keep referring to him as the suspect, it's because he walked out of court a free man. Sadly, in the years that followed, bodies would occasionally be found in the areas this man used to abandon bodies, but he could not be kept under constant surveillance, as not only would resources never allow for that, but it would also infringe on his constitutional right to privacy. In her book, Mickey Pistorius says that she believes the suspect was acting out his hatred for both his mother and the sex worker from whom he'd allegedly contracted an STI when he murdered his victims. Several years after the suspect was released, Sergeant Piet Viljoen, who'd by then been promoted to the Hawks and to the rank of Lieutenant Colonel, was revealed to have been part of a large-scale evidence-planting scheme, and it was discovered that he had planted Francis Celliston's fingerprints inside the suspect's vehicle. Fuljun was also revealed to have been involved in several other instances of fraud and would eventually testify against a group of other police officers who'd been involved in even worse transgressions. Clearly, Fuljun's actions are deplorable. As much as everyone would want justice for these 19 victims, it cannot come at the cost of due process. Fuljun was clearly deeply committed to this case, and I think he really perfectly depicts a police officer who was both committed to doing the job well, but then also at some point went astray. I'm not in any way condoning what he did, but I do have to wonder if he'd just seen too many guilty parties walk away too many times in his career. But then that calls into question every other investigation he was ever involved in, and that is terribly sad for those victims and these 19 women. Of course, it's important to note that although the evidence against the suspect was relatively weak, there wasn't just the fingerprints. He'd never denied killing the woman. He simply said that if he had, he couldn't remember it. And there was that voice recording that was apparently analysed and compared to his voice and determined to be him. But this all becomes fruits of the poisoned tree. They could never place these victims in the suspect's car, and if he had killed them there, surely there would have been some evidence of one of the 19 women in his vehicle. The lack of DNA in this case, due to there being no sexual activity, was also a stumbling block. But in a way, that did point to the suspect, who was impotent according to his wife. The Coke bottle scenario he described to one of the sex workers he'd engaged with was also oddly specific. Today, considering the suspect's already advanced age at the time of the alleged crimes, it's highly likely that the man is no longer alive, but many like him still walk among us. South Africa is highly adept at catching serial killers, and the only reason this man's crimes were missed for so long is because the victims were in a high-risk category. The term serial killer never fails to send chills down our spines, but there is perhaps no more haunting idea than a serial killer that was never apprehended. We know that these types of offenders don't stop, and the only things that do stop them are death, serious illness, or incarceration. When one of the United States' longest unsolved series was recently solved, the now 70-year-old perpetrator of rapes and murders during the 1970s and 1980s, Joseph DeAngelo, told police that the only reason he stopped killing was because he was becoming too weak to overpower his victims, and he knew it would only be a matter of time before he was caught if he continued. Interestingly, his family, friends, and neighbours noticed a stark change in his behaviour when DeAngelo stopped killing. He became like a pressure cooker that would blow up at the slightest thing. Which only makes me wonder how these South African serial killers that got away with murder eventually ended up stopping. Did they die, leave the country and pick up their crime somewhere else? Do they have descendants living today that wonder about their father or grandfather? Most importantly, though, the case we've heard in this episode represents an unnecessary loss of life of so many victims. Victims who never got justice. Their families never got to look their killer in the eye and ask why. And this type of trauma gets passed down through generations, even though we don't always recognize it. So even though So even though it's likely this killer is long gone, his deadly legacy still walks the earth today. In the minds and memories of victims separated by generations from the initial moments of violence, but still feeling the ripples. Christine Fultain, Elizabeth Martinsich, Sarah Mankies, Francina Manuel, Norlundi Mbukwana, Almarie Engelbrecht, Susan Opperman, Margaret Phillips, Bridget Lint, Shireen Yoster, Marilyn Percent, Patricia Gibson, Shahida Abrahams, Gloria Samuels, Frances Celestin, Katrina Fredericks, Elizabeth Thompson, Teresa van der Vint, and the unidentified victim. Rest gently. If you'd like to hear more victim-focused true crime content, please subscribe to True Crime South Africa on Spotify or the platform you're using to listen right now. If you're looking for something still related to real-life stories, but often with a more positive slant, you can check out my new podcast series, I Live Through This. You can follow both podcasts on social media. We're on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'll be back next week with another episode. Until then, thank you for your support, and I'll chat to you soon.